Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest, whom I've been trying to get hold of since the election, is our friend Bill Lechtenberg, the preeminent historian of the American presidency. Bill Lechtenberg, thanks for joining us again.
Nice to be with you always, D.G.
I bet you somebody else, maybe 100 people, maybe 1,000, have asked you, what do you think of this, looking back, what do you think about the presidential election this year?
Well, I think the almost universal response to the election results was that of shock. It wasn't merely that Hillary Clinton wasn't and her followers weren't expecting the outcome, but the Trump people also didn't expect it was going to turn out as it did. There have been two previous elections in my lifetime, one in particular, where the pollsters were spectacularly wrong. But this is an occasion where arguably more people were wrong than ever before.
I remember maybe the Truman.
Well, Truman is what most comes to mind. The first one was when I was a teenager in 1936. In retrospect, we find it hard to believe that that could ever have been in doubt because Franklin Roosevelt won so overwhelmingly. But the leading poll of the day was that of the magazine The Literary Digest. It had never been wrong. It had been calling presidential elections since 1916. In 1932, it had called FDR's victory within 1% of the final total. But in 1936, it predicted that Franklin Roosevelt was going to go down to an overwhelming defeat, carrying almost no states outside the South to the Republican candidate, the governor of Kansas, Alf Landon. And it turned out, as you know, as we all know, to be spectacularly wrong. It used to be said, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. Well, in 1936, the only states that Landon carried were Maine and Vermont. And
didn't even carry Kansas, his own
didn't
state.
Even take carry his
well,
own
how,
state.
Reading your books about the Franklin Roosevelt presidency and just generally sort of thinking that he took hold so firmly and hard that that the people would be reluctant to give him up, but they, at least when they talked to the pollsters, they were ready to shove him out.
Well, there's been a longstanding dispute over how the Literary Digest could have been so spectacularly mistaken. The most common explanation is that they used sources like telephone directories at a time in the Great Depression when so many people did not have telephones. And in an election that overwhelmingly broke on class lines, they altogether missed the extent of the working class following for Franklin Roosevelt in 1936.
This is you brought me up to date on that. The other was the
with 1948, as you were saying, D.G. Pollsters, Gallup, who was only getting underway in 1936, and incidentally had 1936 right. But didn't have the prestige he later did. But Gallup, Roper, Crossley, all of the polls predicted that the Republican candidate, Governor Dewey of New York, would resoundingly defeat the incumbent president, Harry Truman. It wasn't simply the pollsters. At one point on the campaign train, Truman's aide, Clark Clifford, got off because he knew that that day Newsweek was coming out with its survey of the 60 top political reporters in the country, and he wanted to grab hold of the magazine and hide it on the president in case it turned out badly. Well, the survey revealed that every one of the 60 predicted that Truman would lose. But a few minutes later, Truman revealed that Clifford hadn't fooled him at all. Said, okay, Clark, what did they say? And when Clifford reluctantly told him, he said, they're a bunch of damn fools, which it turned out to be right. I remember that election vividly. I was on the campaign staff of a man running for Congress for the first time, Richard Bowling, in Kansas City. So I was in what was in essence Truman's hometown. And early in the evening, it was clear that Dick had been elected to Congress. And then we got phone calls from around the country, from Adlai Stevenson, from Paul Douglas, from Hubert Humphrey, from Soapy Williams, from Chet Bowles, all in one. So big, big Democratic night. But I remember the last thing that I said to a young woman on the staff as I was closing up the office for the night, it's too bad about Harry. Because though Truman was ahead, the leading broadcaster of the day, H.B. Kaltenborn, was saying, just wait for those rural returns. And some days later, I was at a banquet at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington where Truman spoke. And he broke up everyone in the audience by giving a spot-on imitation of Kaltenborn with his very clipped way of speaking, saying, keep waiting for those rural returns. he said that Dewey had snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. He was exultant. And when on the inauguration platform, a calliope came on along playing I'm Just Wild About Harry, he danced a little jig.
Well, why, in this case, in the 1948 election, Truman Dewey election that you've been talking about, looking back, why did the pollsters get it so wrong?
There was a Social Science Research Council study afterwards of the election, and it was a matter of persuading the pollsters to fine-tune some of the ways that they were sampling voters. And they did change what they did, and they've been right ever since, which is
all the
a
way
long
up
time up until this few weeks ago.
Well, I don't want to push you too much on this because I want to talk about the most recent election, but you explained in 1936 that if the pollsters, one of the things that would have set them astray was that they were using telephone books to define the people that they called, and poor people who were hurt by the Depression and still appreciative of Roosevelt's plans to further were not surveyed. Were not surveyed in the right proportion.
Yes.
But now in 1948, you just say that there were fine-tuning adjustments.
Yeah,
that needed to be made.
They predicted
a pretty resounding defeat for
them. They did. And there wasn't the same kind of clear explanation that there was in 1936. But one of the criticisms that was raised in 1948 was that the pollsters assumed that nothing would change in the last 2 months. That's what previous experience had told them.
But the election was decided 2 months before. Yes.
You know,
people's minds were made up.
Yeah. And Elmer Roper stopped taking polls, in fact, 2 months before the election. He said, we might just as well sit back now and prepare for President Dewey's inaugural address. And pollsters learned that they'd better be more careful about that, and they have been.
Bill Lichtenberg, let's take. Yes. You brought us up to date on the two yes. other elections where yes. the pollsters made a big mistake. All this is leading up to how you're going to explain why the pollsters made such a big mistake in the 2016 election. We're going to take a break and take a breath, and you're going to tell us when we come back. My guest is Bill Lichtenberg. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Bill Lichtenberg, Professor William Lichtenberg, preeminent historian of the American presidency and our good friend. And Bill, thank you for taking us back in history, recent history, to talk about how the pollsters got it wrong in two prior elections. But all that's leading up to the question, did the pollsters get it right this time in the 2016 election?
We know they surely did not, nor did any of the people who think of themselves, and probably not without reason, as being the best informed people about election patterns. Everybody was wrong this time. Occasionally in past years, there have been individuals who could claim that they had foreseen what was to happen. Even in 1948, there was a man who disguised himself as a chicken salesman and went around the country and found that more people were choosing the Democratic donkey than the Republican elephant when offered a chance. But I've not heard anybody claim that he or she understood and went on record as saying this time that would be right. Now, you're asking a perfectly reasonable question, D.G., and the simple answer is we don't know.
We don't know yet.
No?
Well, do you think we will know?
I think so, yes. They're already, as with the Social Science Research Council in 1948, there is a careful investigation underway. But I think not only with respect to the polls, but to the larger question of why the election turned out as it did, it's going to be a while before we know. Numbers of people have been confidently offering explanations, but I think we need to be wary of all of them.
Let me try to pin it down a little bit. Everybody agreed that, I think everyone agreed that Trump's narrow pathway to victory was in the upper Midwestern Rust Belt states.
Yes.
In Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, which and those Pennsylvania, those states which were experiencing more than their fair share of economic disruption, and they had in their earlier voting history voted the majority Democrat, that these were reliable Democratic strongholds. Mm-hmm. And something happened to change a large group of those people who traditionally voted Democratic to vote Republican. Are we beginning to get an idea about why that happened and why the pollsters weren't able to put their fingers on that in a way to predict that this hard iron curtain of Democratic states was going to be burst?
Yes, yes. This brings me back to where I started out on discussions of election analysis when I began as a historian. I inherited the big lecture course at Columbia of Alan Nevins when I was in my 20s. And one of the questions we would be asked is, why did the 1884 election turn out as it did? It turned on only 1,200 votes. And
Who were the candidates?
It was Grover Cleveland against James Blaine, the Republican. Blaine lost by only 1,200, which is to say a shift of a little more than 600 votes in one state would have given him the election. And there were a whole series of hypotheses, including whether it was because it rained on Election Day and upstate Republican farmers couldn't get to the polls. And then a historian named Lee Benson, who was at the University of Pennsylvania, came along and said, that's no way to do election analysis. The important thing to understand, to begin with, we're never going to know whether it was the rain or whether it was because Blaine was at an event where a Republican minister attacked the Democrats as the party of Romanism and rebellion, thereby alienating Catholic voters, or whether it was because Blaine went to a big banquet, Belshazzar's feast, at a time when a lot of people were out of work. There are numbers of explanations. And you have to look at an election by examining the entire electorate, the entire result, not those last few states that that determined the outcome. And I think an excessive amount of time, DG, is been going to the question of the Rust Belt states, those few states in the end, rather than looking at what is the single most important thing about the election is that it was so close.
Yes,
as 1884 was.
Well, except that. Excuse me for interrupting your train of thought.
No, go ahead, DJ.
But the 1884 election, as you pointed out, was close in total numbers. This election was not close. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote substantially.
Yes.
So the question is, isn't it, what happened in those states that shifted, that turned the Electoral College vote? So isn't it fair to say, yeah, we need to look at the at what happened in those states?
I'm not saying we don't look at those. It's a part of the of the pattern. But one of the theories of the outcome of the election has been what's called the revolt of the deplorables.
Right. I love that.
Take Hillary Clinton's term for Trump's followers. And it has argument is that the people who are to blame for the outcome, if one thinks that Trump's victory is a source of regret, as I'm quick to say I do, the people who are to blame are people like you and me, because we are a coastal snobs who look down at people in the hinterland, and because the Democrats were so concerned with the fate of undocumented aliens, of transgendered whole groups of people who were outliers in the and the American electorate, that they ignored the core of the Democratic Party, the blue-collar union workers. And for both reasons, it is said, because they were ignored by the policymakers and because they were looked down on culturally, they moved to Trump. Well, that may have happened, and after a while, we'll know more about it. But that assumption is based on very little evidence, most of it anecdotal, most of it pretty slim, and there are contrary considerations that lead one to question that.
And like, what's your favorite contrary?
Well, one is that though it is true that there have been pockets in the Rust Belt that have where workers have been at a disadvantage, overall the economy under President Obama has been doing very well. And a closer connection has to be made between the particular voters and the economic circumstances. What we do know is that Trump's supporters did not particularly come from economically disadvantaged areas, but rather from people who wanted a change for reasons that are not altogether clear to us, and for who were nurturing resentments against the establishment, people in power, and, of course, there's a Democratic administration. So reasonably or unreasonably had those grievances.
If you joined us late, we're visiting with William Lechtenberg. We're talking about the recent presidential election, and we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to try to get Dr. Lechtenberg to talk to us a little bit about what we can expect in the future as a result of this election. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you join us late, I'm visiting with our presidential historian and the nation's preeminent historian, in our view, and our neighbor, Bill Lechtenberg. Bill, thanks for helping us begin to think about and understand why the election results turned out as they did. But right now, more important than what happened and why is what might happen now based on your experience with all the presidents. What can we expect, or what's going to be on this president's table, and how do you think he's going to eat it up?
Well, I think we need to start with the simple point is that Trump is the Republican president who will be working with the Republican leadership in Congress, and it's not only going to be Trump's agenda, it's going to be that we've seen for a good many years now. There's been widespread talk that the highest priority for the Republican leadership is the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And I expect that may well emerge as the largest single issue early in the new Trump administration.
Trump has said he would do it in his campaign promises. He put it out of business the first day, and the people in charge of Congress have been promising something similar. So that's not going to be a problem, is it? That's going to get done, right?
Yes. The question is not whether it will get done, but how great the devastation will be. Because there's also been contrary assertions that certain features, some of the more highly popular features of the Affordable Care Act, are going to be retained. That's what's problematic. That's Republicans have so demonized what they call Obamacare that they have advanced very little program save the destruction of what's on the books without making clear what if anything, they're going to replace it with. And the Democratic slogan of the past week has been to challenge the Republicans with saying that what they want to do is make America sick again.
Well, we may come back to this health care, mm-hmm. Which is complicated beyond belief, at least for me, in terms of what might happen. There are other things that the president has more control and options on, such as relationship with foreign countries. And from my perspective, the president-to-be, the president-elect, has not gotten off to a good smooth start in terms of projecting the American interest abroad in a way, in a positive way that has the people behind him and also has his Congress behind him. Is there any, first of all, is there anything like this ever happened in history before? With the,
I was on a forum at the Carolina Inn some months ago, and I was asked whether there'd been any phenomenon like Trump before, and I said, no, there isn't.
Well, come on, give me a longer answer than that.
I'll be glad to do that. We have we've never before had a major party nominee, and now an elected president who, with no government experience of any kind, no formidable record of public administration, of addressing policy questions. This is what makes predicting what's going to happen so hard, but and also so scary. And especially, as you were just suggesting, DG, in foreign affairs, we can more easily estimate some of the things that may well happen in the domestic sphere. I don't think any of them good, and fields such as the environment, for example. But it's in foreign affairs that he's really worrisome, both generally because of his temperament. It's hard to imagine at a moment of a foreign crisis in the Middle East or in Korea, both of which are areas he may well confront in his first days, that he is going to deal with it with the restraint and intelligence that we would hope to see in an American leader. But if you add to this his curious relationship to Putin and his antagonistic view of China and his talk of trade wars, of building a wall that's never going to get built on the border with Mexico, there are so many, not to use a technical term, nutty notions that...
At least you didn't say a bad word.
that he is advanced, that one can understand why people are as worried as they are.
You mentioned that we have a Republican Congress and a Republican president, so that if they're of one mind, things will go very smoothly, at least in terms of operational, but particularly with respect to foreign affairs, but with respect to other proposals, there's a little sentiment in the Republican, among individual Republican congressional leaders not to go along with Trump and maybe to stand in his way. Can they do this?
To some extent, that's they can, and I think will. In this past campaign, Hillary Clinton, not Trump, was the candidate of Wall Street, and there are many Republican leaders who don't at all agree with him on a trade war, don't have the same attitude toward with regard to policy in the Far East. I think Trump is, at least in the early days, is likely to have more to overcome with the Republican leadership in Congress than he will have from Democrats.
Well, we're visiting with William Lechtenberg. We're talking about the new president-elect and some of the things that might he might encounter during his first few months in office, and we'll continue that discussion after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Bill Lechtenberg. We're talking about the presidency, and in particular, the upcoming presidency of Donald Trump. Bill, it's hard to find precedents, I guess, for some of the things that Trump is doing, including maybe the participation of his family in anticipated participation of his family members in the running of the government or the running of our country. Yes. And do you see that happening? And if you do, have other presidents faced similar challenges of incorporating their families into their close advisory team?
Well, there are certainly precedents for it. The most obvious would be John F. Kennedy's naming his brother, young brother, Robert Kennedy, as Attorney General of the United States. When JFK was criticized for that, he responded he didn't see what was wrong with giving Bobby a little law practice. It seemed to be a very unfortunate appointment, although Robert Kennedy in a number of fields turned out to be a quite effective attorney general. There's been, as your question implies, a lot of criticism of Trump for this. I think it's the least of our worries.
You do? Well,
I do.
Because the other worries are so bad.
They are.
So maybe we should move on to some of the other worries then, other than because you say, or I think you're saying, the family situation is something that is not the president's entitled to have his advisors, and this is not the biggest worry. Would one of the big worries be about the alleged conflicts of interest that that President-elect Trump will face when he becomes president, and those of his family with whatever responsibilities they might have to protect and assert the interest of the United States?
Well, a lot of my friends are talking to me about that, and there's a lot of concern about it. But it too, I think, is getting more attention than it deserves, except in one area, and that is that the Trump holdings around the world are such obvious targets for terrorists and soft targets that it would be very unfortunate if one or more of them became the target for action, and that defending his property became a matter that he regarded as being in the national interest. That I can imagine that as being worrisome. But I was thinking on your earlier question, DG, about the family. I think if we're talking more generally about the people around Trump, the people he's bringing into the government, I think that is an area of very great concern. And so many of the appointments that he has made so far are, for one reason or another, give good ground to be troubled more than the family does.
For instance, which ones? Is Department of State or
Department
or Energy? Or which ones?
You could go right down the line with the ones that you've named. Some of the nominations are raise eyebrows, like the Secretary of State. The Attorney General seems predictable when you get somebody who's been close to Trump in a position of power. It's not surprising that Trump would choose him. It was all but inevitable that was going to happen. But a man with an unfortunate record on civil rights and not the kind of
Jefferson.
Senator Sessions. It's not to be wondered at when he was the only United States senator of any prominence to support Trump right along. That he got a cabinet position. It would have been.
Well, no, that's not unusual, is it?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's the way it works.
It's not to be wondered at. It would have been a surprise if Sessions hadn't been appointed, but that doesn't make him a good appointee.
I want to just shift gears just a little bit.
Yes.
And you brought up Sessions. That was your worry. But it does makes me wonder. Just read these books about our region, about the Wilmington 10, the biography of Julius Chambers, mm-hmm. taking us back to a time when it appeared that government officials, both at the state and federal level, were not sympathetic to the Civil Rights Revolution and other advancing domestic discontent.
Yes.
And it worries me that I'm going on my personal worry, but help me with this, is whether or not the appointments like Senator Sessions as Attorney General and other appointments that nailed in the developing idea that Trump's election is a slap in the face to the aspirations of African Americans, of others, immigrants and others. That there's a possibility that we'll have to deal with stirring up in the communities, in the cities, and that it will have the 60s, something like the 60s all over again.
Yeah, I think that there is reason for worry. If I were an African American, I'd be very concerned about the appointment of Sessions in general about the sense of priorities that we're getting from the forthcoming Trump presidency.
Well, I'm not concerned. I'm worried that the spark of this legitimate concerns about the Trump administration sparks a revitalization of the Black Lives Matters. Disturbance in our city, that we saw that there are still people who feel left out enough that they're willing to go march, a little violence, maybe light a few fires, that we might be in for something like that as a result of the Trump presidency.
The main explanation for the race riots of the 1960s and early 1970s is that they came at a time of high expectations that were dashed. And I don't see that we have quite the same situation today. It's rather that there have been a save insofar as that we have had 8 years of a man in color in the White House being succeeded by Trump and people like Sessions around him. I don't think, though, that in general it can be said that this has been a time of rising expectations for African Americans, but rather a time of attempting to hold on to dearly bought gains. Mm. In the face of evidence that there were people trying to take them away.
Well, Bill Lechtenberg, I knew when we started that when we came time to stop, I was not really ready to stop. But we do our time's up. Thanks for beginning our discussion about what happened in the presidential election and some of the things that we can look forward to happening under the Trump presidency.
For good or ill, and I think mostly for ill, we're going to have plenty of occasion to talk again over the next years.
That will be one good positive aspect of the outcome of the election. Thanks, Dr. Lechtenberg. Thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you know it.